The following is for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog, and we have newsmakers, experts, and top reporters to bring you these stories.
From Tehran with trust, do all the promising statements by Iran's new president and foreign minister really set the stage for a reliable nuclear deal?
Bioideology, the new book Predisposed, shows how genetic and psychological differences underlie increasing liberal-conservative confrontations.
Behind the Nairobi Mall War, a noted Kenyan journalist months ago saw the danger coming from Islamic extremists in Somalia to his country and beyond.
DD Does Day. Jazz veteran DD Bridgewater channels iconic, tormented singer-songwriter Billie Holiday in the new musical Lady Day.
Heart and Soul. Larry Hart, that is, first lyricist for composer Richard Rodgers. Their songbook standards will be celebrated at the upcoming cabaret convention.
Plus notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for your ears only. Now a project of the nonprofit New York Foundation for the Arts. For your ears only, for the week of September 29th, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog.
America prefers to resolve our concerns over Iran's nuclear program peacefully, although we are determined to prevent Iran from developing a nuclear weapon. We are not seeking regime change, and we respect the right of the Iranian people to access peaceful nuclear energy.
Iran is the anchor of stability in an otherwise ocean of regional instabilities. Nuclear weapon and other weapons of mass destruction have no place in Iran's security and defense doctrine and contradict our fundamental religious and ethical convictions. Our national interests make it imperative that we remove any and all reasonable concerns about Iran's peaceful nuclear program.
Although Iran's newly elected and relatively moderate president Hassan Rouhani sidestepped President Obama's invitation for a personal meeting at the United Nations last week, their addresses to the General Assembly were surprisingly congruent on the key issue of nuclear weapons. And a surprise phone call later between the two nations' leaders, first direct contact since 1979, was heralded by many as a breakthrough. Also last week, the Security Council approved a breakthrough agreement demanding that Syria surrender its arsenal of chemical weapons or face UN penalties, possibly but not necessarily including military action.
Doubters saw more delay than real resolution of the Iranian and Syrian threats of mass destruction, but many experts saw a complex web of factors that might ultimately work to reduce the risks in both cases. To consider those prospects and the relation between conciliatory steps by Iran and Syria, we're joined again by Dr. Abbas Milani, Director of Iranian Studies at Stanford University and the Hoover Institution there. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
How important was that 15-minute phone call, half of it taken up by translations? And why do you think Rouhani preferred that kind of communication over a private meeting?
Well, I think he was worried that there might be a photo op and his pictures might appear on Iranian media and conservative papers and cause him more problem than he wanted to have.
In fact, somebody threw a shoe at Rouhani back in Iran, and many observers say he faces opposition from hardliners in the government and the Revolutionary Guard. But aren't they, like Rouhani himself, all just instruments of the nation's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei?
Well, I think that's a very critical question, to find out whether these students who demonstrated at the airport were doing so at his behest. There are several other indications, including very harsh comments from the editor of one of Tehran's most read dailies, an editor that is appointed directly by Khamenei himself, a notorious journalist by the name of Shariat Madari, who immediately gave an interview and said that there is a discrepancy between Rouhani's account of the call and the White House's account. One of the two is lying, and either, regardless of which of the two is lying, this is, and I'm here quoting, an ugly and dastardly act. It is very harsh words coming from a person that is often taught to speak for Khamenei himself.
Is it Khamenei's idea to make the West feel it must deal quickly and sympathetically with Rouhani or risk losing his leverage?
One possible reading of it is that they stage these demonstrations to send a message to Mr. Obama that, look, this is what we have to face at home. There is this lunatic radical fringe. And unless you solve this quickly, and unless you make concessions, particularly lifting the sanctions, it's going to be hard to make a deal.
Just as the Obama administration credited its military threats for bringing Syria and Russia to deal on chemical weapons, it credits economic sanctions on Iran for the new signs of willingness to negotiate on the nuclear program. Remind us how those sanctions have affected life, commerce, and the government in Iran.
Well, they have virtually reduced to a third what Iran exports in oil. The government has just announced that its export this year is 1.5 million barrels of oil. It used to be close to 4 million. The government has announced that it is virtually bereft of foreign currency to buy basic foodstuffs. It has announced all of these are Iranian government. These are Rouhani administration officials who say that they have supplies of food and medicine for only up to 30 days. They say that $600 billion has left Iran and unaccounted for, and the money that the little money that they have in foreign banks as a result of sanctions cannot be returned to Iran. So it is a very, very serious economic pinch, compounded, I must add, seriously compounded by the utter corruption and incompetence of 8 years of Ahmadinejad, an 8-year administration that was forced on Iran by Mr. Khamenei. But now he's paying the price. And most importantly, the poor people of Iran are paying the price.
What kind of results on what timeline will you be looking for if a deal with Iran is really likely?
Mr. Rouhani has given himself a 6-month timeline. He says we hope to do a deal in 6 months. The U.S. has said more like about a year. But I think we will know very soon, within the next month or so, whether the conservatives are going to really try to torpedo this or whether they have made the decision that they have no option but to make some concessions. The problem is, in my view, the problem of the entire regime, whether the more or less moderates or the radicals, is that I think everybody knows they have to make some concessions to get out of this economic difficult times. But they, at the same time, their own rhetoric has created a prison house for them so that they need to sell the concessions as victory. That's why the last 24 hours, the conservatives were boasting about how Iran has become so powerful that the Iranian president rebuked the U.S. president, refused to meet with them. And then the tables were turned.
Iran has been a big supporter of Syria's Assad, and watching closely how Washington and the West deal with his chemical weapons of mass destruction, how do you think the way that scenario has played out with Russia stepping in has affected Tehran's thinking about nuclear negotiations and an actual compromise to defuse international fears?
You know, I think up to the time of the use of the chemical weapons, Iran was doing its utmost to keep Assad in power. By their own reckoning, they have sent about $7 billion in subsidies, oil, discounted oil, to Syria. They have sent thousands of Hezbollah forces. They have sent apparently several, at least 100 IRGC forces. Several of them have been killed in battle. They were trying to keep Assad regime. I think after that, they realized that it might not be possible to keep Assad. They're not trying to minimize their losses and see if they can find some solution that would keep some of their allies in a post-Assad regime. My sense is that with Russia stepping in and with the swiftness of this resolution, they have seen the writing on the wall that Assad's days are numbered and they have to figure an alternative strategy.
Dr. Abbas Milani is director of Iranian studies at Stanford University and the Hoover Institution there.
Quote from the news, obviously they are not pirates. However, formerly they tried to seize our platform. That was Russian President Vladimir Putin after the detention of Greenpeace activists on piracy charges for seizing an offshore oil platform.
Next, bioideology, the role of genetics in today's political gridlock. For your ears only. We have more for your ears only. I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. This was a place where signaling was important. That was Chief White House Economic Advisor Gene Sperling after the announcement that the government would not bail out bankrupt Detroit, but would participate in a $300 million aid package to include improved transportation systems and a bolstered police force. Also last week, Detroit's emergency manager proposed to freeze public employee pensions after mounting evidence of improper administration. Now this.
I intend to speak in support of defunding Obamacare until I am no longer able to stand. The American people want to stop this madness. And so do I. When Americans tried it, they discovered they did not like green eggs and ham, and they did not like Obamacare either. They did not like Obamacare in a box with a fox, in a house, or with a mouse.
So to express your opposition to Obamacare, you go with a book about a stubborn jerk who decides he hates something before he's tried it. And when he finally does get a taste, he has to admit, after tasting it, this is pretty good.
The political play of the week, literally more theatrical than politically practical, was the 21-hour near filibuster by Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz. It was meant to kill funding for Obamacare in exchange for the continuing resolution needed to avoid a government shutdown. In the end, even Cruz himself voted against the position he proclaimed, but not before bipartisan criticism, including the scorn of Daily Show comedy host Jon Stewart. And the issue bounced back to the House, which first introduced the defunding amendment, over which Democratic leaders and the president himself insisted they would not negotiate.
Opposition to greatly broadening private health care coverage even before it fully kicks in, and with many new insurance premiums actually coming up lower than expected, represents some serious concerns over startup delays and unintended consequences, as well as conservative opposition to almost anything Obama. But underlying those conflicting perspectives and the larger partisan paralysis affecting Congress these days are human psychology and genetics. So argues the new book Predisposed: Liberals, Conservatives, and the Biology of Political Differences from Routledge Publishers. And to explain for your ears only, we're joined by one of its three academic authors, Kevin Smith, professor of political science at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Talk about the kind of research that shows political proclivities have roots that go deeper than what we usually think of: family tradition, personal experience, reasoned reaction to external circumstances like the economy, crime, immigration, and cultural changes.
Well, one of the things that we're pretty certain is that political attitudes and behaviors have a genetic basis, and we know this from a variety of different studies. These are mostly heritability studies. They look at things like differences between twins, people who are raised in families other than their biological family, extended family studies. And the bottom line in all these studies is that the closer your genetic relationship, the closer you are on a number of things, you know, the obvious biological characteristics, the color of your eyes, the color of your hair, and so forth, but also on a set of personality traits and also on political attitudes and behaviors. And for people like us, this raises a bit of a mystery, is because we're reasonably certain you do not have a stretch of your DNA that is can be thought of as a liberal gene or a conservative gene. So kind of what's going on? And basically what we're arguing in this book is that while genes might not build a liberal or a conservative, they certainly build the biological infrastructure of our sensory systems, of our cognitive systems. And one of the things that we're finding is that conservatives and liberals differ in their sensory systems, in their cognitive systems.
Well, talk about how deep predispositions affect the way we actually experience the world, tastes we like or dislike, conditions that make us uncomfortable, things we fear.
Well, the bottom line there is we experience the world differently. I mean, a simple example would be that our taste receptors are genetically determined. Based upon our genetic package, some of us think arugula tastes great. Some of us think it tastes like lettuce drenched in gasoline. And that gives us a taste, a preference, a predisposition for or against that particular vegetable. And you can sort of like look at these sorts of biologically anchored predispositions all the way through things like tastes in movies and novels and stories and humor.
And how does that relate to a person's position on the political spectrum, what they fear, what they like, what the moods they favor?
Well, one of the things that we're finding is that these sorts of differences, such as whether you like arugula or not, actually correlate with your political tendencies. And what we think it is part of an entire psychological and biological package that affects how you view the world, how you literally see it, taste it, experience it. And people who see, taste, and experience the world in different ways tend to have different attitudes on a lot of different things, everything from tasting cars to tasting colors. But one of those systematic differences seems to be political preferences, literally a taste in politics.
What do these underlying dispositions mean to the kind of compromise we generally see as essential to a working democracy and which seems in such short supply today?
The short answer to that, the big implication of our research is kind of the obvious. Compromise is hard, not just today, but in any time period. One of the things that we were going through in the last chapter of the book as we were writing it, I kept thinking in the back of my head is you know, the implications of our research really sound familiar to me. You know, when we sort of like talk a little bit prescriptively about what all this research means for the political world today. And in effect, basically what we're doing is putting in 21st century language what James Madison argued in Federalist number 10 over 200 years ago.
The conservative opposition to Obamacare seems to acknowledge that predispositions can be counterbalanced by experience, admitting recently, at least in one case, that expanded health care coverage must be stopped now before Americans come to appreciate and depend on it. What's your reaction to that analysis?
Oh, I wouldn't necessarily disagree with it. I mean, one of the things that we thought really carefully about was the title of our book, and there's a reason it's titled Predisposed and not Predetermined. I mean, these deep psychological and biological patterns and characteristics that we're talking about, I mean, you can think about those as defaults. But just because we feel something, we prefer something deep in our gut, doesn't mean that we can't reason our way out of it. You know, being predisposed does not mean that we are unpersuadable. It means that it's difficult to do so.
Well, polls suggest that dislike of a government shutdown is greater than fear of or dislike of Obamacare, which people still are more mystified by than terrified by. Who do you think gets the blame if a shutdown results?
Well, I mean, this is less to do with our book and just sort of like reading the tea leaves from public opinion polls and so forth. But I think it's clearly the Republicans, and especially the Republicans in the House, that'll get more of the blame for a shutdown than the president.
Kevin Smith is a professor of political science at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln and a co-author of Predisposed: Liberals, Conservatives, and the Biology of Political Differences from Routledge Publishers.
Now this news quote, I guess I'm famous now. Do I get to be on at Piers Morgan's show? That was stripper Lindsay Lee revealing she shared tweets with Newark mayor and Senate candidate Cory Booker.
Next, Behind and Beyond, the Nairobi terror attack, for your ears only. We're back for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog with this news quote. Countries can turn to the Global Fund to sponsor programs that will pull young men and women back from the edge of terrorist violence. That was William McCants, a former State Department counterterrorism official, after the U.S. and Turkey agreed to create a $200 million fund to counter recruitment by extremists with education and jobs programs. Now this.
I promise that we shall have a full accountability for the mindless destruction, deaths, pain, loss, and suffering we have all undergone as a national family. These cowards will meet justice, as will their accomplices and patrons wherever they are.
Terrorists tied to the Al-Shabaab Islamist militants of Somalia invaded an upscale shopping mall in the heart of Kenya's capital, Nairobi, last week and held out against government forces over four terrifying days. At least 67 people were killed in the attack, with dozens more missing and some, possibly including some terrorists, thought trapped in rubble of three floors that collapsed during the government counterattacks, perhaps not accidentally. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta promised an understandably shaken public there would be harsh justice for eight people in custody, accomplices still to be rounded up, and masterminds on either side of the porous Kenya-Somalia border. Viewing the deadly assault as a preview of possible threats to U.S. security, Washington deployed dozens of FBI agents to aid the investigation.
Many questions remained, among them whether the plot included several Americans and a British-born Muslim convert known as the White Widow of a London suicide bomber. Also, why it took so long for Kenyan forces to resolve the crisis despite an escalating series of Islamist attacks elsewhere in the city, and whether police sweeps after those earlier bombings had further alienated Kenyan Somalis who may have helped the attackers rather than tip authorities to their plans. To consider the roots of the crisis and some prescriptions to prevent a recurrence, for Your Ears Only, we're joined by Yaffa Frederick, managing editor of the World Policy Journal, whose new issue carries a prescient piece covering just those points by a top Kenyan journalist. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Who wrote the piece for World Policy, and how long before Nairobi's mini mall war did it come in?
Yes. So we had a journalist named Morris Mora, who's a Kenyan-based journalist who writes for The Weekly, The Nairobian, writes a piece for us actually about 4 months ago. It was June when we commissioned it. And Mora had actually been following al-Shabaab since about 2011, when Kenyan forces had first invaded Somalia.
Al-Shabaab militants said the attack was to punish Kenya for sending troops into Somalia to fight them. Why did Kenya mount that cross-border operation?
So this goes back several years, but when Somalia was broken up in the early 2000s, when the warlords lost power, al-Shabaab was one of the groups that came to power. And one of the places where their pockets of power were was directly along the Kenyan border. And Kenyans were very intimidated by this because at the end of the day, al-Shabaab was a terrorist organization. It was an Islamic organization that was very threatening and menacing. So with the backing of the African Union in 2011, they had gone in to weaken the power of al-Shabaab significantly, which of course angered al-Shabaab, and they had started small-scale attacks into Kenya as a counterattack.
But the piece in your journal indicates that al-Shabaab infiltration for retaliation has been made easier by Kenya's government corruption that facilitates illegal border crossing. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. Unfortunately, Kenyan officials, particularly the ones who deal with immigration along the border, are very easily bribed. And basically all it takes is a few dollars to buy your identification papers. And with that, you have free entrance into the refugee camps and ultimately into Nairobi Central. So the situation that has only gotten worse because Kenyan officials aren't even held accountable by the Kenyan government at this point. And it's an ongoing process where al-Shabaab will send in their people through these immigration checkpoints and ultimately into the city center.
But even Somalis living for generations in Kenya have reason to harbor ill will to government authority, going back to British colonial rule and even harsher post-colonial treatment by Kenyan authorities.
It's certainly true, and it's certainly gotten worse with time, particularly over the last few years, because as Kenyan officials have been dealing with al-Shabaab, they've also been targeting Somalis within their own borders. And while it's nothing new, they've certainly increased the scale of investigation, which means that they're going into neighborhoods of Nairobi, such as Islay, which is known as Little Mogadishu, because it has such a large Somali population. And rather than rounding up one or two individuals who they deem suspicious, they're rounding up any young Somali man and detaining him for weeks on end. And so what Mora discovered when he did this piece is that many Somalis in Kenya are more afraid of the Kenyan police than they are of al-Shabaab.
We read that the terrorists rented a shop within the mall in which to store what they needed for the attack and an apartment across the way where they could observe and plan. And Kenyan authorities argue that Somali Kenyans often help such terrorists out of sympathy or fear. What does your reporting say about that?
So most Somalis that were interviewed for our report said that they had nothing to do, certainly, with al-Shabaab, but they certainly acknowledged that al-Shabaab was present in Kenya, often taking refuge in many of the mosques in the Somali neighborhoods. However, they distanced themselves from it. Like I said, they're more afraid of the Kenyan police or actually of fellow Kenyans in general, because Kenyan people at large have become suspicious of them. They think that any Somali might be a potential bomber. So they certainly don't see themselves as aiding it, but they understandably acknowledge that al-Shabaab is infiltrating their communities.
The author has some recommendations for reducing the problem, starting with a crackdown on Kenyan corruption to shut down the sale of those false documents and better border patrols, but also a softer approach to the Kenyan Somali population. Talk about that.
Sure. So, like I said, in the current form, you have Kenyan police who walk into a Somali neighborhood and round up everyone that they see or deem suspicious. So this obviously creates a lot of resentment and hostility. And what a lot of recommendations have made say that you should go into these neighborhoods and you should plant operatives who live amongst these Somalis and can provide intelligence so that they're your friends and your neighbors rather than this outside force who local Somalis don't trust. So don't round up large amounts of people, but rather plant those forces within the Somali community, let them develop relationships and friendships and provide intel accordingly.
Yaffa Frederick is the managing editor of World Policy Journal at worldpolicy.org.
Now, this quote from the news, the new island will also not stay there for long. That was Ali Rashid Tabriz, head of Pakistan's National Institute of Oceanography, on an island created in the Arabian Sea by the earthquake that killed at least 327 of his countrymen, but which will probably slip back underwater like others similarly created in the past.
Next, Day by D, Billie Holiday as channeled by Dee Dee Bridgewater. For your ears only. We have more for your ears only. I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. The show is more concerned with making Henry a saint than it is with making him funny. Needs to get smarter fast. That was New York Times television critic Mike Hale on the new Michael J. Fox sitcom that echoes the star's real-life battle with Parkinson's disease. Also last week, Sony sold CBS a new crime series by Breaking Bad creator Vince Gilligan. If I went somewhere with a phone book with Vince's name on it, I could sell it, said Sony programming chief Zach Van Amberg. Now this.
I fell in love with you the first time I looked into them eyes. And you have a certain little cute way of flirting with them eyes. Buckle, bubble, gonna get you in trouble. Hey, baby, talking by those eyes.
Iconic jazz singer Billie Holiday kicking off one of her trademark tunes in a 1939 recording, and as it's being picked up these days by Dee Dee Bridgewater, an award-winning singer-actress in her own right, now in the title role of Lady Day, Holiday's nickname, and a new off-Broadway celebration of her hard times, high times, resilient humor, and huge talent. It's a subject that has for decades intrigued and inspired Bridgewater, who won a 2011 Grammy Award for her CD using Holiday's real name, Eleonora Fagan, 1915 to 1959, to Billy with Love from Dee Dee.
Bridgewater also won a Grammy for her Ella Fitzgerald album, a Tony Award for her role as Glinda the Good Witch in The Wiz on Broadway, and was the first African-American to play the classic role of Sally Bowles in a revival of Cabaret. She's also United Nations Goodwill Ambassador, host of her own radio show, NPR's Jazz Set, and on the line again now for Your Ears Only. Dee Dee, welcome back to our show.
So nice to be talking with you both.
After the production of Lady Day that I saw last week, you told the audience you had not really intended to sing as much like Billie Holiday for this show as you now do, not so much imitating as channeling. Talk about how that happened.
Well, you know, her voice is always there in me. From having done the show back in 86 and 87. But I had thought this time it would be more interesting and perhaps could give another slant if I stayed truer to my own voice. But in doing the rehearsals and now the previews, she's slipped back in. And I think that for the audience, it lends more credibility. And so she's just there, and I welcome her back.
You came into the singing business significantly after Holiday left us in 1959, but you said you shared some of the same hard times, trauma, lingering prejudice. Talk about how that helped you inhabit the role.
Well, you know, I'm able to draw on my personal experiences and the emotions associated with those, and it's just good because there is a good parallel, and so it makes it easier for me to draw upon the necessary emotions in the different segments that I do. You know, I hadn't wanted to deal with some elements of my personal life, molestation and rape at a young age, and so it just, those issues it helped me to deal with. It has, on this go-round, I have more information about my family background, and I talk about Billy's father not being accepted into a hospital when he had pneumonia and dying of the complications thereof. That happened to my grandfather.
What would you say was the secret of Holiday's popular success, despite controversy and drug problems?
I think it's just the voice. It's her voice. It's her interpretive manner. She just had a way of making every song that she did sound personal and like it was really coming from her, her own personal experiences. I have heard interviews where she says, said that she only sang songs where she could find a correlation between what that song was saying and her own life or her friends and family.
Your show ends with Holiday on a triumphant note, ending a European tour with a successful London appearance that she hoped would help her win back a New York cabaret card that she needed to sing in the intimate night spots she loved. In fact, it did not. There was the drug problem, but also exacerbated by political controversy about one of those signature songs of hers, Strange Fruit. Say more about that.
Well, you know, when Billy had been presented with that song, it just really, really struck a chord with her because it was dealing with the subject matter that was very apropos to the period with the lynchings and just the significant racial problems that existed during that time and especially in the South. She, I think, found in that song a way to express her dissatisfaction with what was going on at the time and to kind of politicize it. And she insisted on singing it even after she was ordered not to by the government and by local law offices. And it was really the beginning of her true demise because she was so harassed by local law enforcement agencies and had drugs planted in her dressing room, planted in her apartment so they could make arrests. I think that somewhere that really traumatized her led her to heavier drinking and, to her demise.
What do you want audiences to take away from Lady Day besides memories of a great show, great songs, and your incredibly powerful performance?
I want them to take away more information about Billie Holiday and the fact that she was a full woman. You know, she was a human being who was able to conquer a lot of her difficulties. She was a survivor. She was a fighter. She had her way of being militant. She was very funny, very self-effacing, used humor in a large part to diffuse her personal problems and her pains. And I even find a similarity in that this time around because that's something that I do.
D.D. Bridgewater channels Billie Holiday in the new musical Lady Day, now finishing previews at the Little Schubert Theater, 422 West 42nd Street in New York.
Quote from the news, I think this regatta has changed sailing forever. That was Oracle billionaire Larry Ellison on his Team USA's come-from-behind victory over New Zealand for the America's Cup, oldest major sports trophy, which ushered in a new era of bigger, faster, more high-tech, and TV-transmitting vessels.
Next, more music. Veteran vocalist Jeff Harner previews the 24th New York Cabaret Convention and its celebration of songs from the heart, Larry Hart and Richard Rodgers, for Your Ears Only.
A final chorus for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog with this news quote, one of life's great pleasures, and to me, indispensable. That was Wilco guitarist Nels Klein, one of several pop stars supporting campus radio in a 24-hour, 40-nation interconnected college radio day marathon. Now this.
Thou swell, thou witty, thou sweet, thou grand, wouldst kiss me pretty, wouldst hold my hand, both thine eyes acute to what they did to me. Hear me holler, I choose a sweet lollapalooza in thee.
Before Rodgers and Hammerstein, before all those big, meaningful, emotional shows, Oklahoma, South Pacific, The Sound of Music, before their secular anthems like Some Enchanted Evening, You'll Never Walk Alone, Getting to Know You, before all that, there were Rodgers and Hart. Kids from Columbia College, they moved from school varsity shows to Tin Pan Alley and songs for the simpler, sometimes sillier, short-lived shows of the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, like the one we heard cabaret queen Andrea Markovici begin from a Connecticut Yankee. But the songs of R&H 1 have proved at least as enduring as those of R&H 2 for generations of singers and jazz musicians, including Manhattan, Mountain Greenery, Isn't It Romantic, Blue Moon, and My Funny Valentine, to name just a few.
Markovici and fellow vocalist Jeff Harner host an evening of Rodgers and Hart songs during the 24th annual New York Cabaret Convention from October 7th through the 10th at New York's Jazz at Lincoln Center. Other nights of the convention spotlight new performers and another pair of late great songwriters, Jimmy Van Heusen and Sammy Kahn, whose centennial we celebrated on this show back in June. For an insider's view of the full convention, but especially Rodgers and Hart Night, for Your Ears Only, Jeff Harner is on the line again now. Welcome back to our show.
Well, thank you, Catherine. It's good to be here.
I've heard that Rodgers changed the way he composed when he shifted from working with Hart to Hammerstein. To begin with, he didn't have to tour local taverns to locate his lyricist, but how does the music he wrote differ from one to the other? What is the musical magic of a Rodgers and Hart song?
Well, there's actually a great backstory to Richard Rodgers was 16 years old when he was introduced to Larry Hart, who was then 23, and it was a musical love at first sight. And when Rodgers left that day, he was, you know, just declaring, "I found a lyricist! I found a lyricist!" Which is kind of, you know, considering he was only 16, I don't know how long he was waiting, but years later. Around 1943, he was heard to declare, you know, that Larry Hart was a permanent source of irritation. You know, Larry Hart really was alcoholic, and the end of his life was quite sad. And I think around that time when he found Oscar Hammerstein, they really connected in a way that was unique for themselves. But it's hard to compare the songbooks of Rodgers and Hart and Rodgers and Hammerstein. I see them as such separate entities.
The music of Rodgers and Hart is shorter, more clipped, mostly more humorous. It seems that he wrote a kind of a lengthier kind of music when he wrote for Hammerstein.
That's a good observation, yeah. And I there's a level of despair under Larry Hart's lyrics that, I mean, other than Cole Porter, I don't know of another writer of that time who really captured beneath wit and clever internal rhymes, you know, the songs like Glad to Be Unhappy, that you really feel this, you know, deep, dark well of pain underneath the clever rhymes. And it's easy to think of Rodgers and Hammerstein as being more accessible or more family-friendly, but, you know, actually Oscar Hammerstein had a lot to say through his lyrics on racism, and they were both very deep writers in their different ways, but there is just something in the love song lyrics of Larry Hart that is particularly compelling.
Your show's title song is Falling in Love with Love, which comes from a musical with its roots in Shakespeare, who actually lifted it from the Roman Plautus.
Boys from Syracuse?
Absolutely.
Well, and that's a great lyric right there, too. I mean, Falling in Love with Love seems like it's just a rhapsodic, you know, paean to what it's like to be in love, but it's actually self-flagellating about how naive, and the last line, love fell out with me, is, you know, it's devastating.
To what degree is the annual cabaret convention in New York a chance for performers to catch up with colleagues that they don't often get to see because of conflicting schedules.
It is a very big, wonderful opportunity. The case in point right now that comes to mind is Amanda McBroom, who, you know, really lives on the West Coast, but she just happens to be in town to do a couple weekends at the Carlisle. You know, we put her on the bill. She has not been announced, but she will make an appearance on our night to sing 10 Cents a Dance. You know, it's those kind of things where we really do get to see each other in a way that we don't throughout the year.
Even before you host Rodgers and Hart Night at the annual Cabaret Convention, you have an anniversary show of your own on September 30th at Birdland in Manhattan, marking 30 years of collaboration with pianist and musical director Alex Rybak. Is it unusual for a collaboration between soloist and accompanist to last so long?
I think it is. I think it's unusual for anything to last long anymore. I'm just so grateful to have had the continuity of his profound friendship and his brilliant work for so long and through so many different evolutions of our journey. And he's so busy now working with Tommy Tune and Liz Calloway and Faith Prince and on that it's really lovely to have a chance for the two of us just to pause and look back on some of the musical memories, you know, spanning three decades. It's Jeff, our Pearl anniversary.
Jeff Horner's 30th anniversary show with pianist Alex Rybak is 7 p.m. on September 30th at Birdland, 315 West 44th Street in Manhattan, and he co-hosts Rodgers and Hart Night at the 24th New York Cabaret Convention. Very open to the public, October 7th through 10th, Jazz at Lincoln Center, Broadway and 60th Street.
This can't be love. I feel so well, and yet I love to look in your eyes.
And this has been For Your Ears Only. For Your Ears Only on air is also online at iTunes, feedburner.com, and stitcher.com.
This broadcast was engineered by Chad Dugatz at Hanger Studio Play It Productions. With intern Sarah Skirmont, I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern. Our show is a nonprofit project of the New York Foundation for the Arts with support from the Gatewave.org radio reading service for those with disabilities, the Jed Foundation, Fighting Campus Suicide, and award-winning ACAM Associates, exceptional management, impeccable reputation for New York co-ops, condos, and condops since 1983. Learn more at ACAM.com, and please pledge your tax-deductible donation to davidearsonly@gmail.com.
Now we're back with another archive segment, a major story on our show a year ago. I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern. This week last year, we considered the controversy and conflict that provocative communications on and off the internet can have from our September 30th, 2012 broadcast hosted by Eddie Robinson and me.
The strongest weapon against hateful speech is not repression. It is more speech. The voices of tolerance that rally against bigotry and blasphemy and lift up the values of understanding and mutual respect.
Freedom of expression that is not used to incite hatred against anyone. Not a freedom of expression that targets a specific religion or a specific culture.
Addressing the UN General Assembly last week, President Obama presented a very American view of free speech and its power to counterbalance even the most hateful examples of its provocative misuse. But Obama's plea ran headlong into the much more limited view of many conservative, notably Islamic societies, as represented by Egypt's new popular elected president. Indeed, Mohamed Morsi, a former leader of the Muslim Brotherhood, only belatedly spoke out against violence that erupted in his own country and across the Islamic world over a crude anti-Muslim Made in America video on YouTube. That clash of definitions pointed up the difficulties in preserving and policing free speech in an age when technology takes it across so many geographic and cultural boundaries.
Days later, as it happened, the man behind the offensive video, Nakula Baseli Nakula, was arrested, not for the content or its impact, but on suspicion of violating terms of his probation from an earlier check-kiting conviction, specifically using the internet without prior approval. And maybe in a way the arrest was in his own interest, as a Pakistan government minister had offered a $100,000 reward for his death. To talk more about the conflicting values of democracy, religion, and the far-reaching internet for Your Ears Only, we're joined by human rights lawyer Susan Benesch, director of the World Policy Institute's Dangerous Speech Project, also teaching at American University School of International Service. Welcome to our program.
Thank you.
Tell us first about the work of the Dangerous Speech Project. What do you do?
I'm working on identifying the kind of hate speech that tends to catalyze violence. The idea is that hate speech is a very broad, big category, defined many different ways, but that some subset of it is, in fact, dangerous.
Until Nakula was arrested, there seemed little the U.S. government could do about him or his video because of the Constitution's free speech guarantees. Several private internet companies did take action, however, in keeping with laws and customs of other nations. But you've said they owe it to all of us to say more about the standards they use for such steps.
The truth is that it's impossible, even though the internet giants have enormous power to regulate speech all over the world, in fact, more than anyone ever has had. Even they cannot control speech from circulating all over the world and from being used as a pretext for violence, such as what happened in Egypt and Libya and other countries. So, for example, when Google chose of its own, on its own accord, to block the Innocence of Muslims video in Egypt and Libya, you could say that it was closing the barn door after the horse had been posted. The video was already well known in both countries and was already being cited by people inciting violence in both of those nations. So I'm suggesting that although the major internet companies like Google and Twitter and Facebook cannot really prevent violence by blocking speech, they can make a major contribution to both freedom and civility around the world by informing all of us of the decisions that they're making as they confront these difficult situations, and in some cases bending their rules as they did regarding the Innocence of Muslims. The Innocence of Muslims is an especially difficult unusual case because its content did not violate the community guidelines of YouTube, of which Google is the parent company. Those guidelines prohibit hate speech and they prohibit violence that is graphic or gratuitous. The Innocence of Muslims, although highly provocative, was neither.
There's also been proposals for more industry-wide panels to set standards against hate speech or, as you've just said, other expressions likely to cause pain or provoke violence. What's been put on the table? What action do you see likely?
There is a consortium known as the Global Network Initiative, a group of companies that have been working together with independent advisors and experts to work out a common strategy for responding to government requests to censor content. The idea is to make sure that the companies maintain as much freedom of expression as possible on the internet, even as they receive thousands of requests from governments to block content. Now we are just beginning to think about this an entire new arena, which is user-generated content that a company may choose to attempt to suppress because it can be so provocative in a particular country or area of the world. Of course, that can be a terribly slippery slope. So that's the reason why some are suggesting that we develop industry-wide guidelines for reactions to such speech. And I am suggesting that the companies could make, as I said, could do something very useful by, instead of simply blocking content and explaining it generally in a press release, they could, number one, post a notice at the URL where the content was, explaining in simple terms the company's rationale for blocking it, or in the opposite case, for choosing not to block it.
Let's put suppression aside. What about holding parties responsible after the fact, subject to civil damage suits by individuals, companies, even governments who can demonstrate losses more substantial than hurt feelings, deaths, destruction of property? It wouldn't be prior censorship, but paying the price for hostile intent or reckless disregard of dangerous consequences.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right. And the Innocence of Muslims case certainly has stimulated a lot of thinking in this regard for a couple of reasons. One is it is elusive, as I said before. It contains no language directly inciting anybody to violence. On the other hand, and this is the second characteristic that is so striking about it, doesn't seem to have any merit other than its capacity to provoke outrage and insult and violence on the part of certain audiences. It would certainly raise some interesting legal questions to try to sue based on the provocation of violence around the world.
Human rights lawyer Susan Benesch is director of the World Policy Institute's Dangerous Speech Project, also teaching at American University's School of International Service.
The cost of free iSpeech from our September 30th, 2012 broadcast. In the year that followed, Egyptian President Morsi was forced from office by Egypt's military with considerable popular support, at least initially. The military also cracked down on media and other operations by Morsi's Muslim Brotherhood and other Islamic groups. Ironically, last week, the man who made the film that angered so many Muslims, 56-year-old Nakula Baseli Nakula, was released from U.S. federal prison, where he was held since May for using false names in violation of probation in an unrelated bank fraud case.
The government of Sudan, meanwhile, cut internet access across the country to limit knowledge of protests over vanishing fuel subsidies and their suppression. China continued arresting people for spreading rumors, though agreeing, at least on paper, to exempt exposure of government corruption and unintentional forwarding of misinformation. And Pakistan cracked down on mobile phone love chat services as an immoral offense to Muslim sensibilities that greatly restrict romantic liaisons. I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern. We'll visit the archive again next week. Now, Dee Dee Bridgewater with another Billie Holiday classic.
So the Bible says, Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own. Strong get more while the weak ones fail. Empty pockets never make the grave. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own. Money, you've got lots of friends. They all crowd around your door. But when that money's gone and your spending ends, they won't come round no more. Rich relations give a crust of bread and such. Help yourself, just don't take too much. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own. That's got his own.